Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said on Tuesday that $600 stimulus checks could soon be arriving in the bank accounts of some Americans. Mnuchin tweeted that payments may begin to arrive by direct deposit as early as Tuesday evening and will continue arriving into next week. The government will begin mailing out paper checks on Wednesday for people without government-registered bank accounts. Those checks are set to arrive after Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked an immediate vote on increasing the payments to $2,000. McConnell is tying the increase in payments to President Donald Trump's demand to curb the ability of technology companies to assess the validity of comments on social media and purported election irregularities. Democrats are pushing the Senate to pass the higher coronavirus pandemic relief payments, meeting the president's demand for $2,000 checks already approved by the House to replace these $600 stipends called for in the legislation Trump signed late Sunday. The president is also urging the Senate to uphold his veto of a $740 billion defense spending measure, even as he predicts the chamber will allow the veto to be overridden. More than 100 Republicans joined with the Democrats Monday to approve the override of the veto, which would be the first of the Trump presidency. The Senate is expected to consider the measure later this week. The $740 billion National Defense Authorization Act affirms a 3% pay raise for U.S. troops, improvements for military housing, and more. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. Authorities in the state of Colorado reported the first U.S. case of the COVID-19 variant that had been found in Britain. A state health official said a man in his 20s who had no travel history tested positive for the virus and was being isolated in Denver, the state capital. British scientists said the new COVID-19 variant is more contagious than previously identified strains of the coronavirus. The discovery of the new variant led the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to issue new rules on Christmas Day for travelers arriving to the United States from Britain, requiring they show proof of a negative COVID-19 test. The Croatian army is evacuating nursing home residents as well as hospital patients after an earthquake killed 7 people and injured many more on Tuesday in the central part of the country. More evacuation operations are expected as Croatian authorities announce a search for survivors following the second quake to strike the area in 2 days. British lawmakers will vote on a Brexit deal later today. Prime Minister Boris Johnson will speak ahead of the vote, saying a deal he clinched on December 24th will allow Britain to trade with its European neighbors and keep control of its laws and destiny. The accord preserves Britain's zero tariff and zero quota access to the European Union's 450 million consumers, preventing the chaotic split businesses had feared. But it does not cover services, which makes up 80% of the British economy, and trade and goods will still be hampered by red tape and higher costs. A Boeing 737 aircraft returned to the skies over the United States Tuesday for the first time since the plane was grounded worldwide 2 years ago. The American Airlines Flight 718 departed Miami for New York. The 737 MAX was banned from the skies after a March 2019 crash in Ethiopia killed 346 people shortly after takeoff. Prior to that incident, a similar crash of the jet occurred in Indonesia in 2018, killing 189 on board. The aircraft manufacturer has worked with regulators to address technical issues and improve pilot training on the jet. This has led countries to allow the MAX to return to service, starting with a domestic flight by a Brazilian budget carrier earlier this month. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda warns South Sudan refugees to stay out of local politics.
Refugee youths who are in the urban center, particularly in Arua here, are being lured by their colleagues to join in the politics of this country. I want to warn the refugees, let them desist from that kind of behavior.
Security experts cast doubt on Nigerian official culpability claims about recent student kidnapping. Zambia's president receives a preliminary police report on last week's killings at a police station. There are divergent views on the success of Zimbabwe's transitional stabilization program. And South Africa imposes new COVID-19 measures.
We want to decrease unsafe interactions between people. We want to decrease the burden on healthcare services so that resources can be directed to meet the needs of COVID-19 and other patients.
And the International Committee of the Red Cross reduces its activities in Central African Republic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudanese refugees living in Uganda's West Nile region have been warned against getting involved in Uganda's politics. This follows reports that some refugees have registered to vote in next month's election, while others have been seen campaigning for candidates in their host districts. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
As aliens, refugees in Uganda are not allowed to participate in politics, either by campaigning or voting. However, there are reports that some refugees have acquired national identification cards, which will be used in the 2021 general elections. Nahori Oya Awua is the resident city commissioner in Arua, in West Nile region.
The most disturbing thing is I'm receiving some rumors. The refugee youths who are in the urban center, particularly in Arua here, are being lured by their colleagues to join in the politics of this country, to go into procession, and all this unnecessary excitement because of the politics. They are now trying to either buy or lure these youths to join in the politics of this country. I want to warn the refugees that they are here for their own safety. This politics is meant for the nationals. Let them desist from that kind of behavior.
Nahori warns that the refugees' phone politicking will be prosecuted according to Ugandan laws.
When we shall get this information again, make sure you'll be arrested and charged. So the refugee leaders and organizations that are returned here who cater for their own people, please, you summon all your youths and tell them to stop meddling up the politics of this country.
Solomon Osakan is the West Nile region refugee desk officer. He says by participating in Uganda's politics, the refugees risk losing their status.
If we get someone who is a refugee and is registered as a refugee and is getting assistance as a refugee and is involved in politics, we deregister him. He ceases being a refugee. That is what the law provides. So that's why the commandants are there in the settlement to monitor, to check every day and to get reports and see that refugees are doing the correct thing.
Catherine Sikita, a representative of urban refugees in Arua City, confirms her fellow's involvement in Ugandan politics, which she quickly notes is illegal.
As a refugee, we are not supposed to be getting involved into political situations, like supporting any of the parties, directly going out for campaigns and wearing the T-shirts for any of these candidates that are aspiring. And if at all, out of excitement, the youth are getting themselves involved into politics, it's something that really they need to bring to an end.
Peter Lomure Anisi is a refugee leader in Rhino Camp Settlement. He has called for educating refugees regarding the law on political activity in Uganda. Refugees are not allowed to vote or to join political parties in the country.
Our children are now joining political parties in this country. It is not allowed at all. And other community leaders who are in our midst should emphasize this to their members. Parents should also talk to their children. As the community, we are not ready to go and get somebody from police or mortuary.
Uganda is host to more than 1 million refugees, mostly from South Sudan. Uganda holds its national election January 14th. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
South Africa has been taken back to lockdown level 3 as the government battles the second wave of coronavirus infections being driven by a new variant. The new restrictions that have already kicked in have seen beaches and parks shut to the public. The sale of alcohol has been suspended while not wearing a mask now attracts a jail sentence. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The new COVID-19 variant driving the second wave of infections in South Africa has given the government and citizens no peace. More than 50,000 new infections have been recorded since Christmas Eve, forcing President Cyril Ramaphosa to impose new tough restrictions.
We want to decrease unsafe interactions between people. We want to decrease the burden on healthcare services so that resources can be directed to meet the needs of COVID-19 and other patients. These are the key reasons.
According to the new restrictions, all indoor and outdoor gatherings have been banned with the exception of funerals. A new curfew has been imposed from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning. Shops, restaurants, bars and cultural venues have been ordered to close their doors at 8 p.m. Not all South Africans agree with the new rules. Pumla Hamla is one of them.
I, for one, I don't see any need because it's affecting us, especially us who are having our businesses, like dealing with events and whatsoever, who are depending on them to feed us. It's really going to affect us.
Others like Tony Manyangadze are in support of the restrictions.
I think the move was rather too late. You should have done that way before Christmas, honestly, because the virus doesn't move on its own. It requires people to move it from one place to another. So sometimes I think we need to sacrifice a bit in order to gain a lot.
The sale of alcohol has been banned for both on-site and off-site consumption. The government argues that alcohol consumption leads to injuries that fill the scarce hospital beds. But the country's main opposition, Democratic Alliance Party leader John Steenhuisen, wants the government to concentrate more on purchasing the vaccine than crafting restrictions.
Hospitality industry, tourism industry, the liquor industry are all big employers in South Africa. Many people have poured their life savings into building these businesses up. And at the stroke of a pen last night, essentially, they were significantly curtailed.
Johannesburg and Pretoria are among 22 places that have been declared coronavirus hotspots. Barely a month after they were opened, beaches, recreational dams, lakes and public parks have been closed. Anyone found not wearing a mask in public could end up paying a fine or going to prison. The government has defended the restrictions, saying the infections were rapidly increasing and hospital beds quickly filling up. The total number of people infected so far has surpassed 1 million, while deaths are approaching the 27,000 mark. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu has dismissed the country's Deputy Inspector General of Police Operations, Barney Kapeso. The president has also given the Inspector General of Police 6 months to transform the police and regain the public's confidence. President Lungu made the changes Tuesday after he received police preliminary report on last week's killing of two citizens near a police station. Nsama Chipioka, a lawyer of the National Prosecution Authority, and Joseph Kaunda, a supporter of opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema, were shot and killed at a police station. Presidential spokesperson Isaac Chipempe says President Lungu took no action because the report is inconclusive.
As we have said in the statement, it's a preliminary report, meaning that the report is not complete. So that's why the president decided to direct the IG to expedite the investigations it's too early to say anything. Obviously, the president is the only one who has had a look at the report for now, but it's not conclusive, as he has said.
What else does the president want from the police?
Obviously, the ultimate is to know the people behind the killing of the two individuals, and that is what is missing from the report. Everything else could be in the report, but it's not concluded because it doesn't state the people behind the killing.
Isaac, at the same time, the president is calling for changes to the police institution, including, for example, the appointment of a new deputy director general. So is this an admission of guilt?
No, as I put it, there's no clear people behind the killing. It's not clear who did it. And what the president is doing is to allow the new appointees to do their work and to ensure that the culprits are brought to book. So there is no admission of guilt because the report, as I said, has not mentioned whether it was police, whether it was other people behind the killing.
The opposition UPND has said that the invitation to Mr. Hakainde Hichilema to the police station was an attempt to just get him out of the way by implicating him so that he doesn't run against President Lungu in the 2021 election.
No, there is no such intention by the state. The elections, obviously, the president is the last one who would like anyone to be stopped from standing. It's a democracy. We're a democracy. And every individual who wants to stand for president will stand. The case has nothing to do with the forthcoming elections. It's a case that happened way back. And there's just information, maybe, which police have come up with. And they wanted to find out from him what he knew about the case in question. It has completely nothing to do with the elections, the forthcoming elections. So it's not true. No one wants to bar anyone from standing, except those who are guilty of offense, obviously, are not allowed to stand according to the Zambian laws.
Isaac, thank you very much again. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Isaac Chipampi is spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 30th. Zimbabwe's three-year transitional stabilization program comes to an end this week, and a new economic blueprint is set to be implemented in the new year. There are divergent views on whether the TSP, as it is called, succeeded in turning around the economy and whether its successor will change anything. Reporter Kuzaya Musenge has more from Harare.
The government introduced the Transitional Stabilization Program, or TSP, in 2018 following President Emmerson Mnangagwa's election victory. It was intended to steady Zimbabwe's economy, which for several years had been characterized by unbridled government expenditure, huge budget deficits, hyperinflation, and currency instability. Mnangagwa has launched the five-year National Development Strategy, or NDS, to replace the TSP, which ends Thursday. Mnangagwa and members of his cabinet say the TSP put the economy on the right track. They point, among other things, to surpluses in the past two budget cycles, as well as the reintroduction of the local currency in June 2019 and its stability attributed to the introduction of a foreign currency exchange auction system. But critics say the budget surpluses have not improved most people's lives and that the local currency is overvalued, so an unofficial parallel market continues to operate. What's more, shortages of many goods continue and the inflation rate remains high. Economist Persistence Gwanyanya says the success of an economic plan should not be judged just on positive statistics like economic growth if there are no tangible benefits for ordinary people. He says while the budget surpluses can help the country get out of debt, most people see no immediate benefits from the TSP.
Our external debt is currently at around 8 billion, whilst the local debt is around, I think, 13 billion Zimbabwean dollars or so, which is not a so good position for the country. So the surplus that is being talked about is a management tool of getting out of the deeper hole And it would appear it doesn't make sense that Treasury is insisting on surpluses when we are faced with such circumstances.
Peter Mtasa is the president of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. He says the TSP failed because of how the government created it. He said the new economic program also will fail because there are several fundamentals that remain uncorrected, including rampant corruption and misgovernance.
There were no wide and effective consultations of stakeholders. Labor was not consulted. The citizens were not consulted. So they maintained their usual top-to-bottom approach, which has always led to lack of ownership and lack of democratic participation of citizens, as well as lack of accountability in terms of monitoring and evaluation, and also in terms of sticking to implementation matrices.
Danford Mutashu of the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers is among those saying the TSP has been successful. He says though Zimbabwe industry is not yet functioning as well as it did in the early years of independence, it is recovering. He also says that under the TSP, goods and services have become more available.
If you walk into any store right now, across the country, in the rural areas, you know, even in the impoverished areas, there's no shop that is empty that you will find without basics, without all other essentials and other critical goods. So that is a very good base that we've actually built.
Joseph Chuma, a member of the ruling ZANU-PF Central Committee, says criticism of the TSP and its successor comes mainly from naysayers who have never wanted to accept anything good the government accomplished.
Ever since the new disposition came in, we have seen a lot of strides that are taking place towards the restoration of the economy. People are just not talking about it enough. But also, there is so much negativity, and our social media is not doing us any favor as well, because the people will always go out there and make it look like government is doing nothing at all.
Supporters of the TSP blame effects of the global coronavirus and international financial sanctions on some Zimbabwean leaders for the economy's weakness. The National Development Strategy will run through 2025. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
Nigerian security experts are casting doubt on the claim by authorities that tensions between farmers and cattle herders led to the recent wave of kidnappings in the northwestern state of Katsina. More than 300 schoolboys were abducted earlier this month, but later released. Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
Authorities in Katsina initially blamed the mass abduction of 344 schoolboys on gangs of bandits who have kidnapped other people for ransom in the northwestern Nigerian state. Then officials reversed course, tying the abductions to cattle herders at odds with farmers about how to use the land. But retired police commissioner and security analyst Lawrence Alobi disagrees with the idea that herders carried out the attack.
The herdsmen, they don't have any problem with the school authority. They don't have a problem with students. Their problem is between farmers, where they can graze their crops and graze their cattle. So I don't know the relationship between that abduction of those students and the farmers' clash.
Islamist militant group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the abduction of the schoolboys and released the video footage showing some of the abducted boys before their release. The claim, if verified, would mark a turning point for the group, which to date has been active almost exclusively in the northeast of the country. Security expert Kabir Adamu says he believes the abductions were carried out by bandits acting on orders from Boko Haram sect leader Abubakar Shekau.
Call may have been placed at his direct direction. What is more important is who is behind, who are the authority, who makes the calls. So if the bandit group that carried out the attack have subjected themselves to the authority of Shekau, then it means he's the one who finally make the call.
Conflicts between cattle herders and crop farmers have lingered in Nigeria for many years, and thousands have been killed during violent clashes over grazing land. The Miyeti Allah Cattle Herders Association did not speak about the accusations from police, but the group played a role in negotiating the release of the schoolboys.
A lobby says blaming farmers and herders' clashes for abductions may be downplaying or dismissing the possibility of expanding extremism in other regions of the country.
Government is trying to play on the psychology of the people to allay fear, but I think the government should say to the people, so everything be based on facts.
Nigerian authorities in 2016 declared that Boko Haram was technically defeated and recently refuted the group's claims over the kidnapping, describing it as whimpers from a dying horse. But security experts will be monitoring the situation closely to see what happens next. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, says it was forced to drastically reduce its humanitarian activities in Central African Republic after armed groups attacked its office in the town of Boa, Nana Mambiri province on December 27. Jason Strazuso, ICRC spokesperson in Geneva, says the attackers looted buildings and removed all equipment and supplies.
Unfortunately, the International Committee of the Red Cross had two security incidents in the Central African Republic. And what this has done is forced us to reduce our activities in one area of the country, and we're going to consequently increase our activities elsewhere in the country. But there is an increase in the insecurity situation connected to, we could say, the election activities that are taking place there right now. And unfortunately, we're seeing some attacks against our humanitarian presence, which is, of course, something we do not think should be taking place.
Your organization says that you have temporarily scaled down your humanitarian operations. And what does this mean?
When we say we're scaling down our humanitarian activities, what it means, first of all, on the level where we have to insist on keeping the men and women who work for us safe, it means that we're confronted with a situation where we can no longer ensure the safety of the team members on the ground because of the environment that they're operating in, because of these security incidents that we've seen, and therefore we have to pull back. Now, obviously, this means that without the men and women on the ground to carry out our activities, unfortunately, the consequence is that the activities that we're doing, whether we're helping people get fresh water or we're providing a medical care, we're providing food supplies and even agricultural supplies so people can grow food for themselves. These activities have to be put on hold until the safety situation returns to normal.
As you know, just saying, there's tension in the air in Central African Republic. First, the election and the conflict going on there between the rebels and government forces. Does the ICRC know who probably carried out the attack on your facilities?
Well, of course, our teams on the ground will connect with the people that they know and try to figure out who might have carried out these attacks. It's not a detail that I have, nor a detail that I could give you, but we would tap into our networks and find out what happened with the goal of making sure that it wouldn't happen again.
Can you describe for us the type of work that your organization is doing in Central African Republic?
One of our major activities in the Central African Republic is to assist with the healthcare system that's there. We're providing medicine and equipment to several hospitals in the country. In fact, just about a week ago, when there was new violence in the town of Bambari, our teams evacuated 15 wounded people to the local hospital for care. So that's some of the kind of work that we're doing. Outside of the medical work that we're doing, we're providing people with emergency food supplies, and we are reuniting separated families, families who may have been torn apart as they're fleeing some sort of conflict or violence. Our teams are also visiting people in detention and making sure that the conditions there are as good as they can be. And one of the other activities that we're doing in the Central African Republic is to increase people's access to water, because of course, in this part of the world, the very basic item of water is not always available.
Jason Strazuso, a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. He was speaking with us from Geneva. And that's it for this Wednesday, December 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good day.